And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity, and maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing as anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
I mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Hello, hello. This is Dan Platt. This is the Three Left Show. Thank you for tuning in. This is WCAA LP, The Voice. I have a voice in Albany. Things are a little discombobulated. This show is going to be much more less planned than usually. Why? Why, you may wonder? No, you probably know why. In fact, I'm going to start with, God, I don't know, the words to describe what's happening will come, and I will share them all in a particular order, or no order at all, that will make sense now, but maybe in post. All things can be fixed in post, right? Just like this video from Douglas Lane, a publisher of Zero Books, which is a critical theory publisher. He's really great at talking about society as a whole, because this show is about looking at the macro picture instead of following the standard news cycle loop week to week, sometimes even half a week to half a week. Sometimes by the end of a week, the news cycle at the beginning of the week has been rendered meaningless. And certainly everything that seems to matter has been rendered less meaningful by the societal crisis that we are in. Now, this show is not for misanthropes. The show is not for cynics and pessimists. And I'm not one of them. In fact, I'm going to be looking at a lot of silver linings, a lot of all the potentials and the possibilities. My news stream is filled, not completely, of course, but I'm seeing a trickle of stories of this country here and in Hong Kong. They're all doing universal basic incomes to address the crisis. Crisis creates opportunity, but opportunity for who? It seems to be an open grab bag. And I think that is going to be, the tone is a bit more somber here, but here is a video that's 10 minutes from Douglas Lane. I think it's, I basically started my day with it. I find it a good start.
Hello, Zero Books readers and listeners. It's me again, Douglas Lane. And this video is going to be a little bit different. I don't really have a script. I am just going to be talking off the cuff about what I think is going on in the world. Specifically, I'm concerned about the COVID-19 virus and how it's coming up right at the same time as the wheels are falling off of the Bernie Sanders campaign for president in the United States. I feel as though, of course, my perspective is myopic in so much as I'm an American and I'm looking at this very much through my own cultural lens. But it does seem to me that what we have, at least here, is a moment where the administration, the Trump administration, has truly been exposed as incompetent, venal, dishonest. But most importantly, incompetent. And at the same moment, the main challenger to Trump is on the campaign trail. His name is Joe Biden, and not Bernie Sanders. He's a little bit unhinged.
Wait.
This is the clip of him at a factory where a worker goes up to him wearing a hard hat, talking about his gun rights, my gun rights, and Biden is pretty dismissive.
Joe Biden, to me, doesn't seem fully competent or capable. And at this moment, we very much need not only somebody who's capable, but I think we need some new approach to social life, actually. I think we need a new way of organizing ourselves so that we can truly be resilient against this virus. This virus is not neutral. This is an important point to understand, not so much in order to be able to blame the people in power now or to create a perspective where you kind of feel victimized by the world, things could be better, but also to kind of take a Steven Pinker-like approach to the problem and realize that part of the reason why this pandemic is so threatening is because the conditions of our life, at least generally and in the West especially, have improved. And by that, I mean, you have to consider life expectancy and the improvements in hygiene that have developed over the last century, say, and now have created a moment where a virus that really mostly causes a death in people over the age of 60 can seem to be a catastrophe and really not just threaten people's lives, but threaten the everyday functioning of our whole world system. World economy, I guess, but I don't want to just say economy. I want to think of it more as the practical side of life, that we not only is the stock market plunging, but supply chains are being broken and there's runs on toilet paper. People can't find everyday items in the shops. Schools are closing. My own son has been under quarantine. He's in South Korea. And he's been inside his host family's house, not allowed to leave for 3 weeks. I talked to him last night and I asked him how he was doing. And he said that he was terminally bored, which to me meant that he wasn't frightened or sick. So those were good things. But I think that we need to understand that all of this catastrophe is arising in a historic moment, one which the conditions we're used to are being threatened, but those conditions themselves are an improvement. And this moment does not mean that life itself is just a nightmare and we should all take the black pill. As a would-be socialist, I also want to consider and think through how it is that the capitalist system has created conditions where we are unable to rationally respond to a pandemic like this. In the United States, we are unprepared when it comes especially to testing. We don't have enough of the test kits available to be able to monitor our population, to be able to know who's sick and who isn't, to be able to effectively quarantine people and to effectively stop the spread of the virus. From the way I'm looking at it, we've got the COVID-19, we've got the coronavirus, or as my kid calls it, the Crayola virus, and he's 15. I don't know why he calls it that, but we have it. We just don't know how, to what extent, and it's going untreated, and we're headed for a real disaster. And the reason why is because in the United States, the decisions around health are made through the market. They're made through this privatized system. The U.S. government, for instance, relied on private pharmaceutical companies to produce the tests, and also I believe the monopolization of the pharmaceutical industry created a situation where one factory's error, one bad batch, basically stopped the supply of these tests altogether for our country. I've heard rumors that that we turn down an offer from the World Health Organization to get tests from them, to get these kits from them, said we'd make it ourselves. I don't know if that's true. I'll verify that and actually put that in the show notes. But I do know that the focus has been in the United States on the economy for a variety of reasons. One is that, you know, we're always going to be focused on the economy. The U.S. state and every bourgeois state whole job is to keep the capitalist economy going. So it makes perfect sense that when something like the COVID-19 or novel coronavirus comes along, the first thing that you're going to think about is how will it affect the business cycle? How will it affect the banking system? How will it affect the stock market? That's any president is going to think that way. Trump particularly thinks that way. He clings to that more than maybe most would in this context, because for him, coming up on an election with a very strong stock market 3-4 weeks ago, he was very concerned about making sure that that all held in place. What's happening now is the last thing he wanted to see. I mean, it's not a surprise. He was more concerned with himself than he was with the public's well-being. But, you know, it's not just Trump. The unfortunate reality of our life is that we live within a system that aims at producing a kind of value that isn't in service of human beings. We get lucky to consume kind of the shit that the capitalist system produces. Every commodity that is produced as an afterthought. The true purpose is not to create things for human consumption, not to create real wealth, but to create this abstract value, which you can see as digits in a you know, on Wall Street, or you can see it as a dollar bill stacked up in a bank or in your wallet. But it isn't about creating things for human need or even for human desire, but it is instead aimed at creating this abstract value that can be measured in labor time. And because of that, we are always in service of it rather than it being in service of us. Trump is an extreme example, but we are already caught in a system that's inhumane and I think unjustifiable.
Hello again. This is Dan Platt, also aspiring socialist. You were just listening to Douglas Lang, of the publisher of Zero Books, a critical theory publishing house. The book that he's particularly referencing is Capitalist Realism, that what we have is the system we have, and there can never be anything else. But the good thing about a strong crisis like this, it really throws everything out of whack, everything the way it's supposed to be and the way it's supposed to be forever. The fact that we are at the presumption that we're at this end of history, not only politically or whatever, but just as far as diseases like this. But the warnings have been given to us for decades now, especially with the mass production of meat and with the last 20 years where such strains of viruses have appeared on the world stage, but they have not been as virulent as this. They haven't been the true superbug that we've been warned about. But we've been warned. Scientists and experts have been saying we need to be prepared for superbugs. Superbugs that we ourselves are creating because of our super hygiene society. Now, I'm a proponent, somewhat, of what is called the hygiene hypothesis, which is a lot of the allergy problems that we all have, a lot of and our susceptibility and our compromised immune systems is because we over-sanitize everything. That simply rinsing and scraping a dish is not what makes it clean. Scrubbing it with soap or even bleach, completely sanitizing is what it takes. Now, and of course, in a food service setting, I can understand why the over-sanitation is required, because there's just so many more people and so many more types of bacteria being passed around. And that is particularly why an entire economic shutdown, as far as the experts are concerned, those that study outbreaks and viruses, say that that is what is necessary. Now, but there's a number of things to unpack from that last 10 minutes, as long as some other thoughts that have been popping up in my head. That there's everything crisis, you know, maybe you've heard of this before. It's like an ancient Chinese proverb. Crisis springs opportunity. Sun Tzu. But what opportunities? Not only for policy like basic income, mortgage, rent, and eviction freezes. It really goes to show that, like, you know, especially when, like, it took something this big, something this threatening, right, to take such actions, to turn off the spigot of suffering that our society produces. That our government could have done these things at any time, whether it be pump $1 trillion into the economy, which, of course, well, if you don't know, laws have been passed since 08 that basically give the Federal Reserve Bank the ability to bail out Wall Street without Congress. They can just do it. They don't need to ask for permission. They can just do it. That is why this week they did it. Another bailout. $1.5 trillion. The same value as erasing all student debt. The same value as rebuilding and doubling the amount of schools in this country. The cost of fixing all our bridges, renovating most of our public infrastructure, putting bike lanes in every city, just to prop up our rotting system as it is now. But it allows us the space to reconsider everything. Like, terminally bored was the phrase used by Douglas Lane's son. In that boredom, we can spend time with ourselves. We can stop and think, is everything we're doing worth it? Do I really want things to go back to normal after, say, this few-month period of crisis? Because it is very, very overwhelming, especially with all the information available. A lot of it is hokey, blurred, pseudo-information. All the information, no understanding, right? This has been something that technocrats have been banding about all the time, that we're oversaturated with information, we don't know how to understand it. My method is just to break things down, focus on parts at a time, and then collect it all back into the macro picture again. To have a framing of understanding, mine is that of late-stage capitalism, which is the phrase or the term for the ongoing crisis that we are in. That even before the virus, it's been clear to our private sector, Wall Street, that nothing is really quite profitable enough anymore. Especially, as it's been pointed out on this show multiple times, that it's not only a matter of staying profitable, you have to keep being more profitable. So one thing to consider that I wouldn't imagine weeks ago. Let me tell you about how I've been considering getting a bidet attachment for my toilet to replace toilet paper in my life, because I've been steadily getting less disposables in my life. One of the things to reconsider is just how dependent we are on this disposable consumption economy. Not only to keep value pumping around, but just in our own daily lives, that in our own households, we need these disposable items when there are, in fact, alternatives all around us and accessible. So I don't, like many millennials, I think this was a story from years ago, that millennials are buying less paper towels. I have not used a paper towel in my household for 4 or 5 years. I just have a big pile of dish towels. And I barely go through them all, actually. But of course, by the time I get to laundry day, or the time that I get to doing the towels. So usually like one a week I go through. Because it takes that long for it to get, you know, gross. Let's see. I haven't replaced tissues with handkerchiefs, but, you know, tissues are like $1.30 a box. So it's not really that great of an expense. But let's say those run out, then, you know, handkerchiefs it is, or some other type of thin cotton sheet. But toilet paper. Bidets, you know, cleaning your butt with water, and then drying it with the towels that you would have in your bathroom. That's why there's a number of different types of towels of different sizes. And that would be, you know, don't need toilet paper as much. Maybe, or you use like 10% of what you currently use because you're only using it for drying purposes. You're not using it to, you know, three shells at, which is quite wasteful. And the way people think and use toilet paper is extremely wasteful. I think studies need to be done. I mean, conversation I'm just having with my co-host Julian is like, why are people buying so much toilet paper at once? And I'm like, well, when you have a family of four, I see how they go toilet paper really fast. Like they use like 6-7 rolls a week, you know, a roll a day, maybe more than that. I can only imagine because when I had my shop at home job, we would have repeat customers, you know, families, and they'd order once a week. And every week they would order a 12 pack of toilet paper. So I had to assume that they were using 12 rolls a week. So that makes the panic buying of I need enough toilet paper for 2 to 3 weeks, then like I need to empty the shelf. Which is still bananas, but so it is. But now I'm seeing a number of posts about people talking about bidets. Because now that for the first time we've had a shortage of toilet paper, because the supply chain has been disrupted, just a little bit of disruption. Now, of course, it's a big disruption, of course. But again, it's a big enough disruption that now people actually have to like, oh yeah, maybe we shouldn't have this disposable product. Maybe we don't need it. Or maybe we shouldn't be so dependent on it. I think a lot of people will now be thinking about it. Now, I have yet to get one. Okay, that's a failure on me. But I've been thinking about it for like 3 years. But I just never got around to it because it would involve... but I still thought that, you know, even if it took me 3-4 years to really just get off my butt and get it, order it, install it myself, I could probably do it. Have to turn off the water. See, like, there's a bit more steps than just, say, I don't know, screwing a shelf in a wall. But I'd still be an early adopter. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. Now I don't get to be the cool kid who's already self-sufficient. The zero-waste folks are displeased. What else? Okay, so the steps, let's break down the steps of kind of how we ourselves, let's say if we go talk as individuals, should be thinking about this. So let's say, you know, you yourself, step one is fever. You have a fever or someone you know has a fever. Step two would be they go to the nearest testing site, hospital, to get tested. Wait a day, because that seems to be the turnaround, though in other countries, I suppose it's less. It's based on capacity, right? And ours is woefully inadequate. We had 2 months to prepare for this. We thought, you know, quarantining at the airports would be enough. I actually thought so too. This is because I believe that's what I thought what was effective with swine flu, SARS, and at all. There were American casualties from those viruses, but it just wasn't as virulent. And now it's become a pitching war between China and U.S. and where it originated first. So it's just a matter of what super state do you want to believe. Of course, we shouldn't believe any of them. But yeah, like the shutdown of the economy. Oh yeah, the point about billionaires donating kits. That it's up to billionaires with their philanthropy instead of actually having the resources. And the amount that our state and national levels are pitching to, you know, fund things. It seemed like a good amount of money, like $40 billion here in New York, nationwide. Hell no. But now it's an opportunity. Now this, yes, the right is saying it's a wish list from the left. You know, when AOC pitches her proposal, which is really good, which is not only it's not just eviction freezes; it's mortgage payments and rent and taxes. It should be as well. In fact, everything should be shifted because. Everything has stopped. The regular schedule of the year, not only, you know, the sports, so the entertainment industry is completely shut down. Soon as today, well, this later half of the week has been public services, schools, and libraries shutting down for the next 2 weeks. So that 2 weeks is kind of the thing to have in your mind as far as like time frame, okay? If it's a full outbreak, it's going to take a year for this to pass. But by trying to slow down the rate of infection so that less people have it at any one time, that's what closing things down for 2 weeks is meant to do. Because 2 weeks is the incubation period, and then, of course, you have it for and you're active with it for 2 weeks. So if you are, in fact, you know, quarantined or, you know, you're test positive after you go to your testing site, then it's basically a 2 week waiting period. And then it's a matter of, maybe you have enough for 1 week in your household, then it's a matter of relying on others for the second week to get things to you because we're all not going to have it all at once, okay? That's what the shutdown and the slowdown is meant to do. But it's amazing how great this is for our carbon emissions environmentally. Amazing. Like, I think it was a story a month ago. Didn't really get the opportunity to share it on this program. But it was basically just like, you know, satellite photos show that the amount of pollution over China has dissipated. You know, massively polluted skies in China. But because all the factories producing American cheap goods for Walmart, by the way, that kind of production, and disposable goods of all kinds, have shut down temporarily. And it's been great for their skies. It's great for their air. We all know, or we should, that ecology and nature does heal over time if given the time and the space to do so. You just gotta stop the spigot of pollution, as well as our own mindsets that we, you know, just stopping the deluge of capitalist, realist, you know, can't be anything else, bull crap, pouring over our TVs and pouring into our lives throughout scheduling us, to have that stop for a few weeks. I mean, I glass half full, I think it's going to be life-changing for a lot of people. Maybe it'll just make people even more reactionary. Like, I don't want any disruption whatsoever. All the people in the third world can die if it means I get toilet paper again. I'm hoping that's not the case. I think it'll maybe be a little bit of both, as it always is. It's always a little bit of everything. But I think more people even will be woken up because they themselves were shaken by the conditions of life instead of just somebody telling them. Because nothing changes people's minds than actual changes in conditions. It turns everyone into a socialist, so to speak. Because now, at the very least, as a buttress, you have a number of entities in Italy, you know, all mortgage payments. It's amazing. Like, so the spigot of capital going to the top will be slowed, and the evictions and the harm and the stress on people's lives to overwork and or be kicked out or be, you know, the cause of homelessness, evictions, it's all going to taper down a little bit. No one would be calling for these things if there wasn't a crisis like this. But that's what it took. That's what it always takes, it seems. Glass half full approach, historically speaking. This is not going to be the same situation, but after the Black Death in the Middle Ages, or at the cusp, the end of the Middle Ages, also called the High Middle Ages, you know, a quarter of the world population, pretty much in Eurasia, was cut. Died off. Terrible, tragic, horrifying. Apocalyptic. Afterwards, as the dust settled and life started kind of resuming a little bit, everything was actually different. Because now you had peasants and other types of workers that now had way more selling power. And with that, they demanded more rights, more wealth, more of their share of the fuelless pie. And the lords didn't really want to do that, of course. The kings and the lords and the clergy. And the Renaissance and the Reformation and the beginning of Protestantism, you know, the Protestant war epic, thinking about things completely differently in a European-centric way. But of course, such revolution also occurred in other parts of the world. In Asia, they didn't quite recover, actually. But I'm saying these massive shifts have huge macro ramifications. And I'm actually a little positive about it. Because I believe that, let's say we do keep, let's say we tamper down the amount of deaths, the casualty rate, we're successful with our economic lockdown, our social lockdown. It's the social lockdown that's actually probably more impactful than the economic, but they're one and the same at this point. And that's kind of what needs to be decoupled, the fact that we can't stop for 2 weeks and all take a vacation, a staycation. You know, it's also the implications of a general strike. That only a certain percentage, 10% of the population, just needs to not show up for work, and everything just grinds down to a halt. The stock market crashes. It needs another $1 trillion pumped into it just to go up for one more day, and then it'll go down again. Because that's what's happening. It's quite amazing. Everything reconsidering. Let's see. Oh, yeah. So hot take right now, among many others I'm making, is that, you know, these libertarian values are proving to be completely, well, maybe they're not proved to be useless, but they are, in my mind, useless. You know, that I'm a left libertarian. I consider myself a left libertarian, but as I have shown on this program, that I flip-flop a lot. I flip-flop depending on the situation and what we're talking about. What are our goals? Goals of a just and free society require a certain amount of libertarian values, of talking about our own personal and collective rights. Now, collective rights, in the case of a society-wide crisis, means a lot of those individual rights go out the window. People are panicking, not about lack of goods and services and work, though they're doing that as well, but of rights. That, like, this is the opportunity for the super state to clamp down, declare martial law, it's over, we're now in a dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. It's Trump's world now. And that is not an illegitimate concern. But when you're worried about that more than, say, 10% of the country being seriously ill and then 3% being killed, which is the current, you know, fatality rate and intensive care rate of getting this particular virus, when that is less of a concern to you, actually stopping a full plague. Because, see, since the Spanish flu, so-called Spanish flu, but the influenza of 1918, we have not really had a worldwide plague of sorts. Mostly because of modernization across the world in various, you know, uneven ways, but colonized world, it's gotten a lot better. Hygiene, so on. The comforts, the fact that our life expectancy has grown. That's what was referred to as the Steven Pinker approach by Douglas Lane. That Steven Pinker is very optimistic, almost more so, naively so, because he just looks at the main stats of life expectancy and sees that they're still kind of going up, even though for certain demographics, they're going down, like if you're poor. But he also kind of looks at really bad stats in terms of, like, well, poverty is even going down. But poverty has not been adjusted for inflation, and then there's the relative poverty, the inequality between the top and the bottom. That he ignores completely. He just dismisses it. But his contribution is thinking about how much better things are, which A, gives us more space to fall, or it's a longer fall. You can think of it that way. But it's also that way we just have not experienced anything like this. And that's why we're panicking, not acting rationally. If we were, we probably have the testing capabilities ready. It's from a media source, but there's a YouTube channel, Movies with Mikey, and a running thesis of his is that nobody really knows what they're doing. Now, he's usually talking context of movie making and producing media, that, you know, when something's a hit, no one really knows it's going to be a hit. When people try to make a hit, like manufacture one, of course, it doesn't really work out. And that the best films, the ones that are championed and highlighted the most, like, say, Star Wars, that Lucas and his company really didn't know what they were doing. Everything really kind of comes together in very haphazard and non-fixed ways. And no one's particularly perfect because there's always flaws that occur along the way, along with we're all really not knowing what we're doing. Now, what is the how do you react to that? I'll leave that up to you. It's just a thought. But yeah, no, I just want to return to my hot take about libertine values. Of that for the last century, you know, the full libertarian, the right-wing libertarian ideology of Ayn Rand and Cato Institute and, you know, free markets, free minds, don't need state intervention. And any state intervention and reduction of liberty, even temporarily, is the worst thing imaginable. I'm wondering if this crisis will change some minds on that or make it crystal clear why top-down approaches are necessary at times. In the next anarchist show I do, I'll be touching on that, or maybe it'll be the state socialist show, because every so often I do a show that's focused on the positives of state socialism, top-down or centralized approaches, and then, of course, I'll do a show on the necessities of decentralized approaches and how there kind of needs to be a synthesis. No one's really figured out what that synthesis is. I think I've found some inklings of it in Paracom and other such models, but they're mostly theoretical, because we're all kind of doing both always at the same time. We don't really knowing what we're doing. You know, what are the libertarian solutions to a plague? Every man for himself? That the market is going to provide the necessary kits and the necessary advice? No. If it was up to the markets, we'd all just be doing everything as usual, and the flu would spread like an actual plague. We'd all get it at once, and then there wouldn't be enough healthcare facilities to take care of everyone, and then we get that higher fatality rate and more people needing to be hospitalized, and then we don't have enough hospitals. China, with its centrally planned economy, mostly centrally planned anyway, can build a hospital in a week. They built new hospitals in the last month to handle all of the intensive cases. You think that's happening in America? Oh, no. But it's amazing how easy it really is to solve these so-called intractable problems that I run into when I lobby the state and the legislature for this or that. Oh, no, we can't do that. Oh, no, too much rock, too much disruption. We have to wait for something else to disrupt things and create the opportunity. And then suddenly it's so easy to actually do the bad authoritarian stuff, but also to do things in an authoritarian way or the top-down way of declaring a full quarantine, to ban public gatherings over 500. You know, this has political implications. No marches, no gatherings, no conventions, no political assembly. But it also means the government stops. Can everyone still keep going to work at the Pentagon like usual? I don't know. Affects some too. You can only sterilize some things so much. My point is that it just makes the virus matter at us. Because eventually, when it comes to hand sanitizer and that stuff, eventually it stops working. Right? With each time you use it, the bacteria that does survive, you know, that 1% or that 0.5%, it's going to be stronger. It's going to be meaner. It's going to hate us. You know, survivor syndrome. If it had feelings, which it doesn't, but biologically speaking, you know, feelings are biological. So, you know, you can think of them as being similar natural processes. Not the same, but you know what I mean. Yeah, so let's take a look back. Take a look back at some of the things that kind of caused these things to come into being. Now, of course, they're a result of our system itself, right? It's not like we could have really made a different choice as a society if we're going to have the society we have. That's why I have revolutionary politics. We're not going to have anything different unless we change mostly everything. One thing in particular, and I think I was probably going to maybe save this for an environmental episode, it's eating animals will be the death of us. It is time to finally make the connection between animal agriculture, environmental destruction, antibiotic resistance, and disease outbreak. This is by Juliet Galeantri from Common Dreams, published by them. Starting with Wuhan in China, it's a sprawling capital city of the Hubei province. This is central China. And in the epicenter of a culture, education, manufacturing, and transportation. Now Wuhan has a new reputation. It is the city that gave birth to the Wuhan novel coronavirus. The viral disease outbreak, now this is so it seems, or so things have said. Now, I think certain Chinese officials, the health side, have claimed that, yes, this is the epicenter, this is the point of introduction. Now they're battling narratives of some Chinese diplomats, this is on the state level, saying this was actually originated in America. And American CDC officials have claimed that they had found cases of people who they thought died of the flu originally, but post-mortem had died of coronavirus in February, January, you know, earlier than any cases through the airports here. So then it becomes like, where did it really start? Who has the blame? Who has allowed the world to be unprepared? Because, you know, when you admit that there's a superbug going around in your country, it's a hit to your prestige. And that has economic consequences. Can't make as much money. It's all quite satirical and ridiculous. How the personal and the private comes before collective security or collective well-being. And So at least in terms of the big crisis and thinking in terms of revolution and the political change we need and the mass homelessness and depredation of the inequality of our society, you know, I'm looking for the big solutions. I'm looking for the big changes, and having them be diffused and decentralized, it seems all very practical in, as far as, like, what do you do in your community? So there's that. But then there's the state and our entire society as a whole, and looking at it that way. And that's where you start feeling like, well, we just need like a one-party state, and that just knows what the hell it's doing. At least a little bit more than the current one, because at least we all don't know what we're doing, but at least some people are at least thinking about the collective good instead of the individual good. But the trade-off is, oh, now there's going to be torture, war crime, whatever, you know, the things that make the Soviet Union evil and us good. But the evils our state perpetuates are diffused, and they're abroad, and of course on ourselves. So I may title this one Things Fall Apart, this episode, in reference to a poem or a novel about an African society, a village that is torn apart, and everything, the society crumbles because of colonization. And late-stage capitalism, to put it in a short way, is all about us colonializing ourselves, right? The value extraction, the building of infrastructure only to get resources out and not put anything in. You know, the economic booms of the Dakotas and West Virginia and Pennsylvania, it's all really moot because it's destroying the livelihoods of the people who actually live there. It's really just an economic boom for the country, but not for the areas that are being colonized by big gas or this big industry. Let's move through this. Coronaviruses are a common type of virus that cause mild illness, such as the common cold, but can cause more serious respiratory problems. Just a quick search will bring up all you need to know about this coronavirus. Where did it come from? How is the virus transmitted? And what are the symptoms? Can the face mask really help you be safe? So go to the CDC for all that information in the most nonpartisan, value-free way. Wet markets. There are many discussions taking place about how we can prevent and stop the spread of disease, followed by calls from experts for better hygiene, tighter controls at airports, banning the unregulated movement of wild animals, and limiting human-animal contact. But the obvious solution, the simplest and most cost-effective, is that no one yet to admit is to stop eating animals in the first place. This coronavirus originated from one of Wuhan's, and this is the story so far, many live animal markets. Over 100 different animals are sold here, including wolf pups, civet cats, poultry, snakes. These animals are kept in cramped, dirty conditions with direct contact with humans. These markets are referred to as wet markets, so-called because animals are often slaughtered directly in front of customers. Ooh, it's wet because of blood, not feces. That would be my assumption. Aside from the obvious issues of having a high population density made up of humans and animals, a hotbed of disease outbreak, these markets are repulsive places. They are filled with caged, frightened animals, many of them which have been captured illegally in the wild, poached. So it's a perfect storm of sorts. The animals are skinned and slaughtered, sending a cocktail of microorganisms into the air. The dreadful, cramped conditions and mix of wild and domestic creatures, alongside the throngs of people choosing their victims. So you see the moralization of that this writer is doing. That's the slaughter in open-air markets. That is kind of the problem. But of course, like swine flu, avian virus, avian flu, it's also from the mass production of these many thousands of animals all cramped together in one place. Just as certain, you know, just as the spread of viruses occurs because of dense human habitation. So it's also an argument for kind of breaking up our cities and our urbanization a bit. But of course, that brings to mind, it was a meme, but it was a whole other string of thoughts that it was a meme. So there's a meme of it's a road bed. It's a pro public transportation meme. So it's a bus with a crowd of 60 people next to the bus to show how much space they take up. Then it shows the same amount of roadbed with 60 cars and the same 60 people, and showing how much space that takes up. Now this meme subverted that by then saying, by, you know, putting a caption of 60 sick people with the flu and 60 safe, hygienically sealed people in cars. Which gets me thinking about, like, why were cars and suburbanization so popular? And this goes back to, you know, to a lot of other trends, of course, that people wanted the suburbs, right? It was a market demand for it, but it was also, of course, supplied and subsidized by the government at every step of the way. But it was subsidized because people wanted to get out of the city. People wanted to get out of the city because it was, of course, more polluted at the time. And instead of fighting for less pollution, but less, more polluted and less safe as far as diseases is concerned. Not just influenza, which was more fresh in the minds of people in the 30s and 40s, but it's why everyone probably enjoyed driving around cars, or rather saw it as a health necessity of sorts, to get around themselves, or just another positive of it, rather than riding in the bus and mass transit where you pick up the flu, which has I can give a personal anecdote. I never really got the flu until I went to school in New York City. Yeah, never got the flu shot. When I moved down there, I got the flu. I really thought I was dying. It was the first time I'd gotten it, so it was probably really bad. But of course, I'm sure the flus are worse down there in New York City. And all New Yorkers joke about it, by the way. And after that, I got the flu shot every year, more or less. Because after you basically can't keep anything down for 3 days straight, even water, you really start to get worried. Let me finish this. Health crisis. You need only look at the havoc we have wreaked through human history and our damaging relationship. So this is more misanthropic here. With our previous precious ecosystems to realize that we need systematic change. The issue here isn't just about how we slaughter animals. Okay, good. It comes down to the fact that we slaughter and eat them at all. Here in the UK and across the world, we are facing a continuing health crisis, antibiotic resistance, which of course doesn't even have anything to do with a large virulent disease, but it's just that the regular things that are just around us are affecting us worse because we overuse antibiotics not only on ourselves, but particularly animals, livestock. The alarming rise of antibiotic-resistant bugs is particularly a direct consequence of the inappropriate use of them in livestock farming. Due to the cramped, dirty conditions that factory-farmed animals live in, many farmers routinely use antibiotics to try to prevent the incredible range of diseases the animals suffer. So, no cruelty. We must stop tearing down forests. Are you okay, Paul?
Yeah.
We must protect ecosystems and prioritize the safety and freedom of wild animals, leaving them to live their lives away from human contact. If we don't take urgent and far-reaching action now, eating animals will be the death of us. The world must wake up and shun all animal products. No cruelty, no cages, no blood, and no zoos. It's a no-brainer. Juliet is a zoologist and founder and director of a vegan charity, Viral. Full vegan, argument go, and certainly maybe more people will be thinking about that as superbugs and the fact that these viruses, how they come to fruition and occur and affect the global economy is related to mass meat consumption. Everything should be on the table, as it is starting to be. Freezing rents, freezing evictions at the very least. Evictions first, then rents, then mortgages, then maybe taxes, and so on. Just stop collecting. You know, stop transferring the wealth to the top. You know, we stop that, we could actually build things ourselves, because it's not being transferred upward anymore. There's a lot of middlemen along the way with livelihoods and families to feed. But maybe stopping for 3 weeks will make us all think a little bit more about what else we could have. Because now everyone's stuck at home. Everyone should just Google socialist theory now or something. Or just listen to podcasts like mine. Paul Smart, our program director, has joined me in the studio. So he'll join me as I go through two pieces. I think I should get through them. About what to do or how to think when society is falling apart around you. Not to say that it currently is, but let's all prepare for eventualities. And also, maybe let's put us in a better headspace so we're not blackpilling and panicking and feeling like Agent Smith, you know, humanity is the virus. And share the toilet paper, says Paul. Going on. Moving on. So welcome back to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. Radical Leftist podcast, talk show for a post-capitalist future for the show for going in a different direction. So I'm just trying to get my thoughts together. I have here in the studio program director Paul Smart. How you doing?
Much better, much better. I do the morning news. I had to miss a week in there where I lost my voice completely. And just,
but you had the regular flu,
huh?
You had the regular flu.
I had the regular flu, and what they're not, you know, the information that puts everything into context is that it's been a particularly difficult flu season. There's been, according to the CDC, there's been 30 million cases of flu in America since January. And not only that, but, they can test for type A, type B flu and about three others, but there's about 40 strains of flu out there right now.
At any one time.
At any one time. Mm. And, you know, I did the flu shots last fall. My place of work gives them, but it's sort of a gamble as to whether it's the right strain that they're aiming at.
Yeah, they're always just predicting which one they think will be
right.
The major
and,
one.
And so, you know, at the same time that...
Which is how you get people like, I had the flu shot and I still got the flu. Vaccines are evil.
Well, yeah, but it's...
And don't work.
You give it a try for those years that you don't catch the flu, especially as you get older. It gets rougher. How we got the flu is kind of fascinating. We were actually in North Italy and left Milan on the same day that they then closed it down. We had no idea at the point that we were leaving. We did a family vacation there, you know, went down to Genoa and the Italian Riviera.
I think you mean Genoa.
Genoa. And we went to
check that
some
accent.
Of the fashion shows. One of the fashion shows of emerging talents in Italy. And that was the day before we left. And, you know, as we came into Milan on the, I believe it was the 16th of February, they had people checking the temperature of everybody coming into the airport, which is what the president talked about doing in this country. But I'll get to that in a second. So, they were checking temperature. The big sign for COVID-19, once symptoms show up, is a fever of 102 or above.
Nice.
With the flu, it tends to be...
I'm wondering how you're walking when you have, when it's that high.
You can, I guess. But anyway, we came in. My son had a... this tends to happen when we travel. He had a cough and a sore throat most of the time we were gone. You know, you pick up things on the airplane, et cetera, but all was fine. We came back. He went to school. You know, we came back. We flew back from Milan to Madrid. We leave Milan. We see a few people with masks in the airport there, but they tended to either be Asians, and we were I was talking to one family who said they were wearing the masks as much as to have people around them feel comfortable as anything. Because
it's a signifier.
Yeah. At the very beginning of all of this, everybody was blaming Asians, as are a number of people in our government to this date. Yeah. Then there was one family that had it that was just all worried. And they flew with us. We flew back through Madrid. When we arrived in Madrid, there was no sign of masks or anything. Anywhere we go into the city, it's just packed, as was Milan on...
You're talking about Madrid now.
Saturday, yeah. As was Milan on the day before we left. I mean, you forget that these are pedestrian cities.
Oh, sure. That's what you mean by packed. They're just
busy. Everybody's out. It was gorgeous weather.
Sure.
And...
Mediterranean climate.
Yeah, and then we get back to our hotel room in Madrid before flying the next morning back to JFK, and that's when we start to see news of Milan, places that the day before were packed, completely, you know, emptied out.
Sure.
So we get back, and, you know, I go to work.
Here in America, it's just empty roads.
Yeah. I go to work on Tuesday and Wednesday. My son goes to school on Tuesday. Throws up, comes back, spends 2 days, and he's better, but we decide to keep him out for the week. You know, turns out it's flu. My wife then catches it, and then by Wednesday evening, I'm just knocked out. By that Friday, I'm not well enough, but I figure, you know, I better go for a test of some sort. And I call my general practitioner with Cap Care, who says, you know, anything that might have to do with coronavirus or that has to, you know, if you've come into the country in the last week or so, we're sending everybody to the emergency room. So I went to Albany Memorial on Northern, and, you know, they immediately kind of sequester me off. They've got me wrapped in robes. Everybody around me, they're saying, oh, this is a way of testing the protocol. And, you know, 3 hours later, they're sticking... The main thing on the test is that they stick a swab up each nostril, like about, I mean, farther than you think a swab could possibly go. It's very painful.
They didn't give you any numbing agent?
No, no.
What?
No. They just say, this is going to hurt. And it's like, yeah. And
the nose doctors give you a numbing agent before they stick things up your nose.
They didn't. You know, they did
which is still really uncomfortable, but at least I wouldn't call it painful.
They did all of this, and about halfway through, they tell me, look, you've got flu, but you're not checking out, you know, for coronavirus. I said, is there a, you know...
So there were testing kits.
Well, this is where it gets very vague.
Or are they guessworking it?
No, it gets very vague because, as they said, they didn't want to contact CDC at that point because it would have meant,
would have meant paperwork?
No. They would have shut the emergency room down.
Oh.
Yeah, because, and then later
So then you're weighing, like, this greater good of preventing outbreak versus treating the people that are in the ER.
The protocols weren't set up. And we're shifting
that as well
at all moments. So, you know, I'm given after 3 hours.
Can I? Because there are things I want to get to. The story is useful, and it's good to share it.
Yeah, but you get to your thing anyway. It turns out I had flu. My wife went through similar testing. Turns out she failed two of the tests, so they held her for a week and a half at home. Mm-hmm. Finally, it came back, and they said, yes, it is flu. They tried to hold her for another week, and she also got a negative on the coronavirus test. And, you know, we said, no, you can't hold this when we don't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we were all let.
Then you assert your individual rights.
Right. But throughout all of this, you know, the major thing that's not getting out there is the fact that there's so much flu at the same time. And that's the same for both.
Sure. Basically, 2 weeks, stay out of, you know, stay at public space.
Drink a lot of liquid.
Now, I've had, my temperature has been down a degree. I've had cold symptoms for 2 weeks or less, but it happened a year ago as well. Mm-hmm. Just achy joints, particularly my shoulders or knees.
Well, I wrote a piece this week about how, I mean, it used to be the same with blizzards before every blizzard became a snowpocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would get the flu or you would have a series of snow days and you'd basically stay in for 2 weeks and kind of work your way through.
Or you wouldn't go out as much.
You wouldn't go out, right. And you would.
But without any big snowstorms, we're all just kind of cycling around like normal.
Exactly.
Hmm.
So, but, you know, all of these things are seasonal.
As we've been told for decades, climate change exacerbates these disease factors.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But we haven't been, well, we're not going to change our ways until we're forced to.
But and you know, that's kind also of just a lot of
forcing
you know,
ourselves
it's
to.
Almost as if this is the first time that we've had a serious crisis of any sort with everybody holding smartphones in their hands, and I think that's exacerbated the stress level of everything. We're constantly looking for new information when it can't. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter.
And a lot of it is just not needed. Though, of course, my Facebooking has been centered on conversing with people in a reasonable manner, mostly either making fun of those that are panicking or at least having some jollies, but also discussing ourselves about like how concerned do we need to be and who are we trusting at the moment. Of course, it's going to be the immunologists, people who know what they are talking about and have looked at these issues for decades. And so they're technically the most prepared and mostly just saying what we should have been doing to be prepared and what we can do now to at least react.
It's a great time to, I mean, one of the publications that I write for wanted to change everything this week. You know, we had prepared a whole issue around the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, you know, and various different topics, you know, which I kind of take on from a semi-Marxist point of view.
Well, true. Like my point of view that I've been talking about in the first hour, which of course I didn't use any Marxist jargon because I try to avoid it, but it's that to really protect ourselves, to be safe, is to be more ecologically in line, which of course is always the case of the eco-socialists like me. Which is to say, like, if we really want to protect ourselves from what's really dangerous in this world, not only disease outbreaks, but homelessness and want, we need to be more ecological. We need to stop overproducing.
We need to actually cut back our economy. You also kind of bring.
But that's it makes you unelectable. But that's in this system, it makes you unelectable. So thus the revolutionary politics comes in again, which it always will with me. Which is like, look, I'm not really interested in gaining any office. I mean, it would be nice. I do feel some jealousy towards those around me, my age, who are doing that. And actually are in a position to actually be public about, like, we should freeze evictions and freeze rents. And I have the power to call on that versus being just a schmo slacktivist or an activist. But yeah, so let's go to Margaret Killjoy. I forget who she is, but she's definitely a writer. And so this was published in Slingshot, but this is from her own blog. So, you know, people publish things and it gets shared. Via other publications. Slingshot is an anarchist newspaper, which is free to distribute. But anyway, this is from How to Live Like the World is Ending. Now, of course, this is even more apt now, but of course, she wrote this last year, and of course, you know, with climate change, the world as capitalist will as we know it is ending. And we need to be, should be mentally prepared for it. Otherwise, we panic buy toilet paper. Anyway, so how to live like the world is ending. The world might be ending. There's a commonly replicated piece of anarchist folk art that means a lot to me. I don't know who drew it. It's a drawing of a tree with a circle A superimposed. The text of it reads, "Even if the world was to end tomorrow, I would still plant a tree today." I grew up in anarchy around this piece of art. It was silkscreened as patches and posters and visible on the backs of hoodies, walls, collective houses. It was graffitied through stencils, and it was photocopied on the back of zines. It's a paraphrasing of a quote misattributed to Martin Luther, the original Protestant, Martin Luther, not Martin Luther King, although plenty of people misattribute the quote to him as well. The original quote is sometimes something like, "Even if I knew that tomorrow the world would go to pieces, I would still plant my apple tree." The earliest reference to it anyone can seem to find is the German Confessing Church, a Christian movement within Nazi Germany that sought to challenge Nazi power. The quote was used to inspire hope, inspire people to action even against the times as they were in the 30s. That's something I can get behind. There's this book that means a lot to me, On the Beach by Nevlin Shute. I've never read it. I can't bring myself to. I think about it quite often regardless. The novel describes a nuclear war destined to kill all life on Earth. And it describes the last days of people living in Australia waiting for the inevitable death of all things. Think about like The Road, Mad Max kind of worlds. Those kind of dystopias. It describes how they live their lives, how they find meaning during the apocalypse. It's a book about how to live without hope. It's a book of resignation. It's too much for me, I think, at least right now. The world might be ending. A lot of people will argue with me about that. They will correctly point out that a large numbers of people all over the world, especially in the parts of the world long ravaged by Western imperialism, the world has been ending for a long time. They will correctly point out that the world itself isn't going anywhere, that change is constant. And even if what is left behind by climate catastrophe and war is a scorched desert, it's probable that life will continue. Human life, non-human animal life, and plant life will all, in some form, survive. People will argue correctly once more that most every generation has believed that the world was ending. The machine gun slaughter of World War I, the genocide of the Second One, the doomsday clock of the Cold War, the AIDS epidemic, those all must have felt like the apocalypse. For entire peoples, they were. Yet, here some of us are today, alive. None of those arguments detract from the fact that it sure feels like the world is ending. Mountains are blown up for coal to pump poison into the air. Pipelines clear-cut the last vestiges of the wild to help us pump more poison in the air. Oceans are swallowing islands. 100-year storms happen every year, and it feels like every day we break new climate records. A sense of urgency about coming disasters is fueling a rise of "I got mine, F you," nationalism, and climate scientists are being ignored to an unconscionable degree. The world is ending. It's always ending, but it's ending a lot right now. For me and the people I'm close to, it's ending more dramatically than it was when I was born 37 years ago. That is paralyzing. The news is full of extinction and fascism and death and death and death. And we're expected to get up in the morning and go to work. For a while, I coped by means of a cycle of denial and panic. The potential apocalypse was basically too much problem. I couldn't wrap my head around it or its ramifications, so I acted like it wasn't happening. Until, of course, some horrible event or reminder of the apocalypse broke over a certain threshold and sent me spiraling into despair. Then numbness took over once more, and the cycle began again. That didn't do me much good. About a year ago, I decided to embrace four different, often contradictory, priorities for my life. I run my decisions past all of them and try to keep them in balance. They are: act like we're about to die, act like we might not die right away, act like we might not have a chance to stop this, act like everything will be okay. This is what I do too, more or less. First one, act like we're about to die. Every breath we take is the last breath we take. You only live once. Smoke them if you got them. Do as thou will. Memento mori. Our culture is full of euphemisms and clever sayings that focus around one simple idea. We're mortal. So we might as well try to make the most of the time we have. Embracing hedonism has a lot to recommend it these days. It's completely possible that the majority of us won't be alive 10 or 20 years from now. It's completely possible, although a lot less likely, that a lot of us won't be alive in a year. I used to think that I was younger, that I was a terrible hedonist. As a survivor of sexual and psychological assault and abuse, I've never had much luck with drug use or casual sex. But drinking and getting wasted, while perfectly worthwhile pastimes, are the only ways to live in the moment. Hedonism is about the pursuit of pleasure and joy. The trick is to find out what gives you that pleasure and joy. For myself, this has meant giving myself permission to pursue music, to sing even though I'm not trained, to play piano and harp, to travel, to wander, to seek beautiful moments and accept that they might be fleeting. I'll rudely paraphrase the host of the rather wholesome podcast, Eulogies, Ali Ward, and say, "We might die, so cut your bangs and tell your crush you like them." If you're a romantic, it's eating a piece of cake. My hedonism is a cautious one. I'm not looking to take up smoking or other addictions. I'm not trying to live like there's a guarantee of no tomorrow, just the solid chance of no tomorrow. Frankly, this would be true regardless of the current crisis, but it feels especially important to me just now. Principle 2. Act like we might not die right away. Preppers have a bad reputation for a good reason. The people stockpiling ammo and food in doomsday bunkers, by and large, don't have anyone else's best interests at heart. Still, being prepared for a slow apocalypse or dramatic interruptions in our status quo, wink, wink, make more and more sense to more and more of us. And I think even more after the following month. Or it's hitting people right now. Preparing for the apocalypse is going to look different to every person and every community. For some people, it means stockpiling necessities. For others, securing the means to grow food. That reminds me, I should be ordering seeds for the coming year. One thing I've learned from my friends who study community resilience and disaster relief, however, is that the most important resource to shore up on isn't a tangible one. It's not bullets. It's not rice. It's not even land or water. It's connections with other people. The most effective means of survival in crisis is to create community disaster plans, to practice mutual aid, to build networks of resilience. Now, that seems to be counter to the social distancing principles that we're kind of allaying ourselves. But again, the point is that we shouldn't all get the virus at the same time. So while some people are sick and need to stay at home for 2 weeks, you bring them food a week out, you know, so they don't have to stockpile in the first place. None of us do. Every apocalypse movie has it all backwards, when the plucky gang of survivors holes up in a cabin and fends off the ravaging, chaotic horde. The movies have it backwards because the ravaging hordes are, in the roughest possible sense, the ones doing survival right. They're doing it collectively. Obviously, I'm not advocating we wear the skulls of our enemies and cower at the feet of warlords, though wearing the skulls has its appeal. I'm advocating staying open to opportunity and building collective power. There are infinite reasons not to count on holding up in a cabin with your six friends as an apocalypse plan. Thus the jokes about quoting Shaun of the Dead, which is a pretty funny joke. Hopefully we are, in fact, doing the opposite, not taking that seriously. First, because living a worthwhile and long life as a human animal requires connections with a diverse collection of people with diverse collections of skills, ideas, and backgrounds. It's all fun and games in your cabin until your appendix bursts and none of you are surgeons, or you're the only surgeon. Likewise, small groups of people who tend to agree with one another are subject to the dangers of groupthink and the echo chamber effect, which will limit your ability to intelligently meet other challenges. Second, because of removing yourself from society, you're removing your ability to shape the changes that society will go through during a crisis. Yeah. If you go hide in the woods with your stockpile and your buddies and fascists take over, guess what? It's kind of your fault because you weren't at the meeting where everyone decided whether to be egalitarians or fascists. And guess what? Now that rampaging horde is at your doorstep and they want your ammo and your antibiotics and they're going to get it one way or the other. Fascism is always best stamped out when it starts. It's never safe to ignore it. Not now, not during any Mad Max future. Tangible resources do matter, of course. Any likely scenario that prepping is good for won't be so dramatic as in other restructuring or collapse. It might mean food shortages, power outages, water contamination. It never hurts to keep non-perishable food, backup power, water filtration, and around you and your neighbors. Still, this is a terrible basket to put all your eggs into. You probably shouldn't live out your days, whether they're the last ones or not, over-prepping for something that may or may not come to pass. Part 3. Act like we might have a chance to stop this. Now, she's talking about climate catastrophe more than a flu outbreak. But societal crisis is a societal crisis. We can and we should stop the worst excesses of climate catastrophe. We can and should stop fascism by whatever means necessary. Throwing up our hands and walking away from the problem is no solution at all. It's hard to remember that we have agency. Unless we were raised ultra-rich, we've had the concept of political and economic agency stripped from us at every turn. We've been told that there are two ways to affect change. Vote for politicians or vote with our dollars. Both of which, at this current moment, are becoming amazingly contrite. Or a bad joke. Politicians in Western democracies are likely incompatible of changing things as dramatically as they need to be changed. And they certainly won't bother trying unless we motivate them to do so in fairly dramatic ways. As for economic agency, there is a small handful of men with more wealth and therefore power than the rest of us combined. We've been told we cannot take matters into our own hands, politically or economically. We're not allowed to have a revolution. We're not allowed to redistribute wealth. You'll be shocked to know that I don't put a lot of stock in what we are or aren't allowed to do. Still, even if we give ourselves permission to undertake it, revolution feels like an insurmountable challenge. We've got, optimistically, 10 years to completely overhaul the economic system of the planet. It can be done. It has to be done. Yet it feels like it won't be done. I'll be getting to that hopefully in the next episode, actually. Like what we should do in the next 2 years, flu or not. And maybe this crisis is going to help with that. I think it. My glass half full approach is certainly that it will. Which is that we need a revolution. Like, not a political, like, voting a new person in, but, like, we actually need a full change of government. This revolution, any revolution, really. So, anyway, let me back up there. We're running a cost-benefit analysis of acting directly. We all have different points, breaking points. The point beyond which we can no longer prioritize our immediate well-being, you know, self-care, I need to sort my own stuff out, I need to get a better job and buy a house of my own, which is sort of the mode I'm in right now, which, again, I'm always like, but of course I'm delaying thinking like that, and maybe that set me back the last few years. That's because in my own mindset, it's like, does it really matter whether I own a house and have a mortgage and a state job? The point beyond which we can no longer prioritize our immediate well-being, but instead must act regardless of the outcome. In the meantime, we're waiting until it seems like we can act and actually have a chance of winning. But waiting does not make things happen. Unless it's for the boss. But then I usually have a breaking point where after 20 minutes, I'm like, I'm not waiting for the bus anymore. I'm going to walk. All over the world, even in some Western countries, people are no longer waiting. They're acting. We need to be helping them, supporting them with words and actions while we are get ready to act here as well. The revolution needs mediators and facilitators. So that's kind of the skill set I've tried to develop. It needs medics and it needs brawlers. It needs hackers, propagandists. I tried my hand at that as well. That's kind of the show. And it needs financiers and smugglers and thieves. It needs scouts and coordinators, and it needs musicians, and it needs people invested in the system to turn traitor. It needs lawyers and scientists, bookkeepers, copy editors, cooks, and it needs almost everyone, almost every skill. New society needs every kind of skill. One thing it doesn't need, though, is managers. The people who claim to know how to run a revolution don't know how to run a revolution, or they would have done it by now. The authoritarian urge to decide what the revolution should and shouldn't look like, how people should and shouldn't express their rage and reclaim their agency, will fail us every time. Authoritarian communism is the death of any revolution. Authoritarian liberalism is the death of any revolution. Even the most dogmatic anarchist will get in the way if given a choice. The revolution cannot be branded, despite Hollywood representations of rebellion. They don't work as well under a single banner. They are diverse, and they are not revolutions. Though our media puts a color, you know, color revolution, it's one thing. No, it really isn't. The revolution cannot be controlled by a vanguard of activists. If it is, it will fail. The revolution must be controlled by its participants, because only then will we learn how to claim agency over our own lives. We have a chance to stop this. I forget that sometimes, but I shouldn't. Still, I can't count on hope alone, or the days when hope fails me would lay me low. Part 4. Act like everything will be okay. All the times the world has come close to ending before, it hasn't. It's ended for some people, some cultures. Civilizations have collapsed. Ecosystems have radically shifted. They're never fully destroyed. They just shift. Species have gone extinct, including some species of humans. Colonization was an apocalypse. Some people survived those apocalypses, but plenty more didn't. Still, the world is still here, and we are still here. Capitalism is a sturdy beast, quite adept at adaptation. Marx was wrong about a lot of things, and one of those things was the inevitability of its collapse under the weight of its own contradictions, because it can always form new ones. With or without capitalism, the society we live in might stagger on. We might curb the worst excesses of climate catastrophe through economic change or wild feats of geoengineering. I won't bet on it, but I won't bet entirely against it either. As much as I need to live like I might die tomorrow, I need to live like I might see 100 years on this odd green and blue planet. Unless things change, I'm not burning every bridge. I'm trying to maintain a career. If I was certain to die under a fascist regime by 2021, there wouldn't be much point in writing novels. They take too long to write, publish, and reach their audience. I get some joy from writing myself. Sure, but I get more joy from putting my art in front of people, of letting it influence the cultural landscape. With novel writing in particular, that takes time. That takes there being a future. I want there to be a future, almost desperately. Not enough to bank on it completely. I'm keeping some small portion of my time and resources invested in the potential for there to be a future is important for my mental health because it keeps me invested in maintaining that health. The world might end tomorrow. It might not. If we can help it at all, we shouldn't let it end. We ought to act like it might. We ought to figure out what trees we should plant either way. Thoughts, Paul?
What? I got lost there.
Yeah. You were doing some phone watching there.
Yeah. Actually, while you were reading that, I was thinking a little bit of someone I may end up seeing later this afternoon, James Howard Kunstler. Do you know?
Oh, he's speaking somewhere?
No. We're going to go up to Washington County, and I've known him for years.
Your personal friend with Kunstler?
Yeah. Yeah, he's a bit of a – he actually – we were living deep in the country when he came by for dinner one night. And
so I'm 2 degrees from Kunstler.
He got us freaked out because, he was right before the – around the time the long emergency came out.
Well, for the listeners, this is a community radio station. Who and what does Kunstler promote?
Kunstler is a writer. He had started off as a novelist, and then he kind of shifted into writing about planning issues. He wrote a really influential book called The Geography of Nowhere that talked about kind of what a mess we've made of our American landscape.
He has a pretty good TED Talk. When our boys die in the sands of Iraq and they're bleeding out, is their last thought of home going to be the meridian between Kmart and the interstate?
Yeah, or what he talks about
is that a country worth dying for?
All our towns have been kind of desecrated by these convenience stores with their lit up canopies in the middle of what had been a beautiful landscape, breaking our role in history. He then went on from there and eventually wrote a book called The Long Emergency, which had been serialized in Rolling Stone, and it was about how we've kind of reached the peak oil and it's all downhill from here, that at some point we have to weed ourselves from oil, shale, any of these fossil fuels. He then put that, and this is what got me thinking, was as you were reading that, he wrote a series of 4 novels, which are called The World Without End novels. And it all takes place just to the north of here. There are some parts of them that take place in Albany.
Which is where he lives.
Yeah, and it's in a world where all the oil has gone through, that we've, it's only in the final novel that you get a sense of what happened to create such a catastrophe. But what's occurred is that everybody's been forced back to a simpler life, to small communities.
I don't prefer calling it simpler, but certainly
a more agrarian life. And the first book, there's one character who's moving towards something that's feudal. There's another group that's doing something communal, but a little bit cult-like. They're a fascinating look at things. Going back to that dinner when Kunstler came by, the first time he came for dinner, he was talking about how, you have to be prepared for when everything comes to an end, all the power, etc. And, I was realizing we had a stream, but it was about a mile away, that it would just be, that I could put a cistern up on, we were living in an old schoolhouse, I could put a cistern on top and collect rainwater, which I had done years ago living in Alaska. But, the smartest thing seemed to move to a village on the river, on the Hudson River. Where there's a train line, and
let's go to Kingston.
Kingston's a bit big. This was Catskill, which was actually, and Albany is actually still a very workable place. All the cities in this area were built where they are for reasons. Mm-hmm. They're close to water. Which provides power, when you go back to things. There are rail lines, there's, other things that are usable. So anyway, that's what got me thinking, when you brought up the idea of seeds, we're about to plant our seedlings this week.
I definitely think about water power being like the most dependable, quote-unquote, alternative energy source, more so than solar and wind. Which are very, can still have, require massive supply chains.
Although wind is still if you spend.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. If you jerry rig a windmill, like the kind in Africa, of course.
Or if you go back to, you still go across the Midwest or out into the West and you see windmills everywhere.
Sure. I'm just, I'm confusing my macro with my micro, but let's just say we're talking about micro generation for a few homes. Water wheels and creeks and such things. And windmills, like, you can actually make it mechanical energy, and then you can heat water with it.
There is a, years ago I was working on a whole story, and there's a fascinating, when rural electrification was first taking place during the Roosevelt era, there were a number of very small electrical cooperatives that were set up around the country, and a number of them are still in existence.
In the New Deal era, a lot of co-ops were actually started farming or otherwise. It was quite the movement. But the thing that's like the co-op movement, and this is kind of a strike against old anarchism and maybe even new types, is that like all those co-ops, you had this new economy that could band together, and a lot of these co-ops did band together. And then they became, by the 60s, corporations. Like when I worked for ShopRite, which is a big corporation, 40 stores across the Northeast, and they act like the same goddamn corporate structure, but its ownership is still family based, and the families are the cooperative families. So there's this legalistic definition that ShopRite Corporate, Wakefern Corporation, is still a bunch of cooperatives,
there are a few
really get out of the system. It's
like Cabot Cheeses and Milks and all of that is a dairy cooperative in upper northern Vermont. And then there are a few
best damn cheese in the area.
In the electrical world, there's down in Delaware County, there's a Delaware County electrical cooperative.
Anyway, what was your point about cooperatives?
Was that a few years ago, they were working on a whole protocol of working with European technologies to create mini turbines in one's homes that work both with the water that you're running and with the water that you're flushing to create electricity.
Yeah, the mini turbines you put in the pipes.
Yep, and it's been squashed by the larger companies. If you look...
What do you mean? How do they squash it?
They're just not...
The technology or the...
The technology. There's just not a push in that direction. I mean, and it makes perfect sense because it involves decentralization.
You mean markets favor the larger players that control the resources?
I know, it's quite strange.
And don't actually allow for innovation?
Going back to Kunstler, I just pulled up. This was his thing from yesterday.
Right, so Kunstler is also a really great speaker on urban planning. He's really investigated a lot.
Because
the geography of nowhere is like on the list of like urban planners to read about how suburbia destroys social life.
Yeah, he writes for all the top publications, and he has a very... his blog has a name that we can't say on the radio, but you can find it at Kunstler.com. That's K-U-N.
Doesn't he also have the Kunstler cast?
S-T-L-E-R.
He has a podcast called the Kunstler cast.
Yeah. And here's just from yesterday's blog post. Had enough excitement yet? At least the stock markets are following an established script. The bubble pops, the elevator drops, for a while it stops, and then investments sink to the deepest sub-basement where they linger for a long, long time. Hello, next Great Depression. We know how that story goes, even if it hurts. This coronavirus is something else. It engulfs whole populations in a fog of confounding narratives. Is it no worse than a bad common cold, except for old folks already half gone with chronic illness? Or does it really slam people even in the midst of life? Well, Wuhan hospital director Liu Zeming, 51, went down 2 weeks ago, and gastroenterologist Zi Cixi, 29, and Dr. Peng Yinhua, also 29, and some prominent Iranian politicians and lots of very sick healthcare workers from Korea to Italy. Whatever coronavirus is, I'm not persuaded that it's a hoax. So he goes into this long.
That is his style, though.
He's truly discursive, and he's a bit of a misanthrope, and he takes on left.
But in that, he was kind of jumping back and forth.
Right, and he does that a lot.
There's one thing to make systemic critiques that then you're basically critiquing everybody, but then just making the jab about a hoax, you're just jabbing at the right.
But what he does is that he raises lots of questions, and by the time he works it down into a book, and especially with that last series of novels, it was distilled into something that was quite persuasive.
I wouldn't say he's the guy. I wouldn't say he's the guy to go to for solutions to things, but he's definitely a great describer of the issues.
But here's an interesting. I'm just going to finish his little thing from yesterday. He goes into talking about the Democratic primaries. He says coronavirus has provided a chance for the former Veep to duck out of the spotlight, where he spent recent weeks blathering incoherently and starting fights with voters.
Don't forget the mic check.
And now something really nefarious may be afoot with the Dems. If the wounded Bernie Sanders does not use Sunday's debate as an opportunity to expose Mr. Biden's dementia and finish him off, here's the DNC's playbook. Hope that the stock market crash and broken economy sink Mr. Trump in public opinion, then contrive to nominate Mr. Biden and get a black woman on the ticket as Veep. That part of the story has been trotted out already. I'm beginning to wonder whether that black woman will happen to be Michelle Obama, and I'm also wondering whether Barack Obama is behind the scenes orchestrating this. Of course, Mr. Biden, if elected, will serve in office less than a week, just long enough to hustle him off with the 25th Amendment. Voila. The Obamas are back in the White House.
That's pretty contrived, but yeah.
The Obamas are back in the White House, out-Clintoning even the Clintons. Happy days are here again. Not.
He has a great sense of humor, by the way. This TED Talk is as funny as
He's
it is
also
alarming.
One of those people that does not sleep. I don't know if you've run into people like that who just do not sleep.
Well, I guess that's how he produces so much. Yeah. Oh, he's a regular, he's our Edison, I guess.
As the program kind of director hat on, we are sprinkling throughout the day. I found a number of informational PSAs, some of them from the CDC, one or two from the State Department of Health, and our health commissioner, Howard Zucker, who speaks very fast, by the way. And then, most importantly, I found a number of pieces from the World Health Organization that are very clear. One of the things that is clear is that whether it's flu or a bad cold or, you know, symptoms that seem to be COVID-19, you deal with it the same way. And here at WCAALP, you know, we're urging people to drink a lot of liquid, wash your hands a lot, get a lot of sleep, and listen to a lot of radio. We're going to be playing some great music, you know, hopefully bringing your stress levels down and kind of just telling you what you need to do to stay chill as we work through all of this.
That's right. Great. And now I'll add a mic. This has been the Three Left Show. I've been your host, Dan Platt, with program director, Paul Smart. The Three Left Show is on social media at Facebook and Twitter. This show is found on all podcast apps in an edited form, going back the last 10 episodes. So if you get tired of even the radio, you can always go to that. There's plenty more at the website, threelefts.news, numeral threelefts.news. Only that. That is where full archive of episodes, all 70 of them. Which I am now at. This is episode 72. Thank you very much. And then we're going to finish the show with five stair steps. Things are going to get easier.
And this is, there's a great version of this done later.
Yeah.
Ooh, child, things are going to get easier. Child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter.
Someday, yeah, we'll put it together and we'll get it undone. Someday, when you hit it much lighter. Of a beautiful sun someday when the world is much brighter.
Ooh, child, things are gonna be easier. Ooh, child, things will be brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna be easier. Ooh, child, things will be brighter.
Bunker Records.